What's the other issue with lots of services running and lots of things configured? The more patches that are going to impact your environment. The more stuff you have, the more patches, and we know the difficulty of patching in control systems. Therefore, we have to recognize that a lot of these systems in production that we didn't lock down, which we're going to cover tomorrow, typically have lots of extra services. Many of them are running Unix systems from 10 or 12 years ago. 10 or 12 years ago, what were the common services that were typically on Unix boxes? FTP, Telnet, SNMP, SMTP, DNS, port 80. You typically had a lot of your small services like Echo and Chargin and a lot of those, TFTP, UDP port 69. All of that extra stuff was typically there just in case. So you have a lot of these systems in the field that have these services running. Now, the fact that the services are running is problem one. What's really the bigger problem? You're not using them, so you never configured them, which means now these services are not only running, but running with default passwords, anonymous access, no passwords, and all the default level access, which means now all the base default passwords like guest and others are very, very easy ways of breaking in. One of the most common ways that we break into control systems is logging in as guest with no password. Why? Because 10 or 12 years ago, that was a very common configuration on Unix systems as an easy way in. And because organizations aren't configuring or locking it down, that's a very, very simple but very effective way to be able to get into those environments today. Also, a vendor needs to be able to get into their products, typically remotely, to perform administrative functions on that system. Therefore, they're going to have built-in passwords that have the same value across most of their product install, so their technicians can easily get into any of the boxes quickly and fast. Also, if you're running a large utility company and you have over 30,000 field devices with over 150 field technicians, what are you going to do? You're going to make the accounts and the passwords the same on all those devices in order to make it scalable and easy for your field technicians to perform their job function. Now, if you've had the same accounts and passwords for 3, 5, 8 years, it's only a matter of time until that information leaks out. It's only a matter of time till you have a disgruntled field technician that shares that information with others. Also, let's not put it out of the realm of possibility, is field technicians typically don't get paid a ton of money. If I offered a field technician $10,000 for a username and password, would every one of them do it? No, but wait. For my attack to work, do I need every field technician to be bribed? How many? Just one. So the question now is, 150 out of 150 field technicians will not take a bribe to give up the user ID and password. But one probably will. And I only have to find that one. That's the issue, and then I'll get into all of them. Also, I don't have to even bribe one of them. What do I need to do? Just go to one of the remote terminal units, sit there, brute force it. Once I figure it out at one, I can then get into any. So based on scalability and deployment challenges, we tend to have a lot of issues with these administrator accounts, passwords, backdoors. And in many cases, they're very rarely changed. The passwords don't expire, and they often don't meet complexity requirements on your system. Once again, you have to remember security is about the lowest common denominator. It's about the weakest way into your system. We go to a lot of our customers and they say, oh, Eric, it's okay. We have strong access for our passwords. We have 15 character passwords that get changed every 90 days and they have complexity checks and account lockouts. And I say, for what percent of the user accounts? Oh, for 95%, Of all accounts on that system, we do that. Great. If I'm an attacker, if you're an attacker, and 95% of all the accounts have strong, robust passwords that change on regular intervals with account lockouts, and 5% don't, which ones are you going after? The 5%. You're only as strong as your lowest common denominator. So don't tell me that 95% is secure. Let's focus on the 5% that's not, because that's what adversaries are going to focus on. So that's often the problem that clients, we're trained in school. If you get a 95 in school, that's a good grade. If you get a 90 in school, that could be a good grade. If you get a 90 in security, that's not a good grade, because that's still 10% exposure. So it's the opposite. We're not looking at what you did right. It's always the lowest common denominator that somebody's going to use in order to break into those systems. Then many of these control systems also have a lot of proprietary protocols and services run on these systems. And many of these proprietary protocols are written with high availability. If you want high availability services, what do you need? Verifiable code. If you need verifiable code, what do you need? Simplicity of code, which means all extra functionality is removed to make the code as lean as possible so it can be verifiable from an availability perspective. What is often removed in making code lean? Security. You can have highly functional, stable code that has absolutely no security in it, and it's easier to verify and have a higher chance of uptime and availability. So a lot of these proprietary protocols do not have much, if any, security built in from a protection component. Then many of these devices are still using services that were very, very common 8, 10, and 15 years ago. We see a lot of FTP and Telnet and POP3. What's the problem with those protocols? Not only is everything, including the user ID and password, plain text, but many of these have backdoor features. Do you realize FTPs, you can actually go in and do command injections and run commands on the server via FTP? You can do relays. Most FTP allows anonymous access, guest accounts, and other ways into those systems. Then we start getting in to the security settings. Great. So we have security built in. Let's start with the biggest area of issues, which is crypto. Crypto only works if you have a good, robust algorithm. We have a little time on Saturday where I give you a little bit of crypto, but we don't go into a ton of it. But let me just give you the golden rule of crypto. The secrecy of the ciphertext is based on the secrecy of the key, not the secrecy of the algorithm. With good crypto, you never trust proprietary algorithms. You always want algorithms that are publicly analyzed and disclosed and verified for over 10 years. Well, what's the problem with those? They often have licensing associated with it. So many, many vendors write proprietary encryption that's not very good. Writing good crypto is very, very hard. So our last lab that we're going to do in about an hour and a half is going to show you how we can take the firmware of a chip and show you where the cryptographic keys are stored to steal and extract them off the system, because proprietary encryption is not very robust. Problem one. Problem two. Even if we're using a good, robust algorithm, crypto is only good if the key is protected, secured, and locked down. Well, in many of these devices, the key is stored in the device, which means if I get access to the device, I get access to the key. And if I get access to the key, the purpose of the crypto is defeated and not really giving us the value that we're expecting from that protection. We then also have a lot of things run as administrator. Why? It's quicker and easier to function. If you're a field technician and you installed a new service and it's running as a normal user and it's not working correctly, You're getting errors. You're getting read-write messages. It's not functioning. And you log in as root, and you then run the service, and it works perfectly. What are you typically going to do? Leave it running as root. So because it's quicker, easier, simpler, and doesn't require as much troubleshooting capability, many things are running with higher privileges than are needed. And now you have services that are not secure running at higher privileges that now can be attacked, bypassed, and taken over by an adversary on the system. So at this point, let's take our afternoon break. It's 3 o'clock, so we'll come back at 3:15. We'll then do a little more. We have about 30 slides and 2 more labs to go, so we're actually tracking real nicely tonight to get you out of here by 5:30. Otherwise, enjoy your break, and we'll come back in 15 minutes. Now that we've looked at attacks on HMIs, we're now going to look at a related area, attacks on the control servers. Many of the control servers that are being deployed today are actually using more and more of the common operating systems that we would run across within an IT environment. We are seeing many Linux and Windows-based servers, which means we now have issues with the default configurations, locking down the services, patching many of the common attack vectors like buffer overflows, and then we're going to look at some of the related servers like historians, databases, and how some of those attack vectors would work. From an operating system vendor perspective, since more and more of these control servers are using Windows and Linux, if you create an operating system, what is your utmost primary goal? To make your customers happy. What makes your customers happy? When everything works correctly. Therefore, it's very common that vendors will have all the services turned on, all of the accounts running. So this way, what you need is there, available, and functional on your system. If the operating system vendors deployed a server that was locked down and hardened with no additional services, you would have to do a lot of work. You would have to turn on those services, and the chances of you being frustrated would be very, very high. Therefore, it's not uncommon for a lot of these systems to have built-in accounts, extraneous services, and security settings not properly configured in the environment to minimize any interoperability issues that might come into play. So we're going to go through and walk into each of these different areas to understand how these exposures might be exploited by an adversary. When you're talking about control servers, you need to be able to have vendors access those servers. You also need to potentially have a wide range of operational staff that are working 24/7 be able to access those systems in a quick, fast manner if there is a problem or an issue. Therefore, it is very common in control systems to have built-in administrative accounts with preset known passwords that many individuals and/or vendors know to provide easy access into those boxes. The issue, if you're going in and relying on critical entities to get into those servers quickly, those passwords often are not changed. They don't have complexity checks in place. They do not have account lockout, which means the opportunity for somebody to be able to brute force those passwords are very, very high. And the chances of somebody being able to find out the password and use it to get into that system for the next 9, 12, or 18 months is also a big problem. So because these systems have known fairly easy passwords that often are the same across installations, that becomes an easy attack vector for somebody to go after. Also, extraneous services. Many services open up ports, and ports provide an access point into the server over the network. Many control system vendors also put in proprietary protocols and services, which typically don't have proper security or encryption in play, which creates another opportunity for an attacker to get into the box. Then add on one of the themes we've been talking about this week, which it's not uncommon for control systems to have a 15, 18-year life cycle. So you very well could have servers in your environment that were built 8 or 9 years ago, which means many of the traditional extraneous services that were deployed in Unix boxes back then, your Telnet, FTP, POP3, SNMP, Echo Charging, could still be running on those systems and provide an easy way for an attacker to be able to break in and compromise the environment. A lot of those standard services, like Telnet and FTP, have a couple of major problems. First problem is everything is sent plain text. The username, password, everything can easily be sniffed. Now, combine that with the fact that the Telnet and FTP traffic might be going over wireless, and wireless is a hubbed environment by default, which means anybody could be able to see, intercept, and gather that information. Then you start looking at the fact that FTP allows anonymous access and can be used as relay points, and that starts creating a lot of areas that an adversary can go after. Then when we look at our security settings, many of the security settings are not set up correctly, with the first one, of course, being crypto. Crypto doesn't work if you don't have a good, robust algorithm and properly protect the key. On Saturday, we're going to spend time going into a little more crypto, but I just want to give you the golden rule of crypto now to set the stage for this slide. The golden rule is the secrecy of your ciphertext is based on the secrecy of the key, not the secrecy of your algorithm, which means good crypto, you only want to use publicly disclosed algorithms. Translation, never trust proprietary. Well, a lot of equipment out there for ease of use is using proprietary encryption, which therefore has vulnerabilities and exposures that could easily be compromised. Also, all of the robust algorithms in the world are not going to help if you don't protect, manage, and control the keys. So when you're talking about servers, where are the keys actually stored? How are they protected, controlled, and monitored? A lot of the devices, authentication is done via passwords, or in many cases, if you have physical access to the device, there are ways that you could bypass and get around any of the controls that are in place on that system. As we've talked about, patching is a difficulty when we're talking about control systems, because control systems are all about reliability, availability, and integrity of the systems. Anytime you alter, modify, or change code, it can impact the reliability of those devices. So therefore, it's not uncommon for these devices to go months or years without patches applied, because that could impact the testing and the verification and validation that has to be done in those areas. But this creates an interesting conflict, because on the one hand, as we know, a patch is the vendor publicly disclosing that there's a known vulnerability and method of exploitation on their system. So the longer we go without applying patches, the greater the chance that a system can get compromised. On the other hand, anytime you patch, alter, or change the code, it increases the chances of vulnerabilities, issues, or reliability associated with that device. So now we have this conflict where on the one hand, we want to patch, 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 and on the other hand, we never want to patch. Now this gets a little bit into our day three material on how we protect against it, but the trick of patching is during testing, remove extraneous services to minimize the number of patches that are required during production. And therefore, by going in and taking away that vector, it is not uncommon that if you have a properly secured lockdown control system, that it can actually go for years with having minimal patches required, because it's a minimal code base that's running on that box. Also, going in and leaving your system in an unpatched state could leave the opportunity for an attacker to be able to break in and compromise your box. So as we mentioned, The way we minimize that risk is by removing services during testing so the production boxes have less chance of having to install a patch to minimize the impact to the reliability of the system. Systems that require one patch every 2 to 3 years. That's not unheard of if you do proper mitigating measures up front. So the trick is don't fight the patching issue. Create an environment where patches are no longer a requirement, and that will go in and minimize the impact in your organization. So with patching, it's better to go in and get rid of the need to patch, because otherwise trying to patch and change everything is going to be a constant uphill battle. Then one of the other big attack vectors on servers are buffer overflow attacks. In order to understand a buffer overflow, let's just briefly go in and look at how a normal operating system functions so we can understand how a buffer overflow attack would work. A buffer is nothing more than an area in memory that stores information and variables as you're running a program. So let's start off by looking at a normal program and seeing how it functions. So the buffer is an area in memory that stores our results, and we're going to be executing code on the server. So these are the lines of code that we're going to be executing. If I'm currently executing this function right here, what do I need to keep track of? I need to keep track of where in the program I'm at. Because if I'm going to go and run this subroutine, I need to be able to know when this subroutine is done, where do I return in my program to continue executing. So what do? I take the memory address of the next line of code, and I push it on the stack as a return pointer. Now I go and I run the subroutine, and this subroutine creates a variable of 30 characters. And this says, please go and enter the valve that you would like to control or monitor. So you're going to go in and you're going to enter in valve 30. It's going to push it on the stack. And then the subroutine will go in and execute some command against valve 30 in your controlled environment. Then once the subroutine is done, what do? We go to the return pointer, we go to that memory address, and we execute the next line of code. So that's basically how a normal program works and functions in the environment. Now, what if we have an attacker? What if we have somebody evil who's trying to go after and cause harm? They run your program, the return pointer gets pushed on the stack, and the subroutine says, please enter the valve that you would like to control. Because I'm an evil attacker, I would now go in and enter 40 characters on the stack. I would now enter in exploit code that's going to give me a root shell on your control server. And then I overwrite this return pointer with the memory address of the variable. So now what's going to happen? Now, when you're done with that subroutine, what is your program going to do? It's going to go to the return pointer. It's going to go to the memory address of the return pointer, and it's going to execute the next command at that memory address. And I'm now going to get you to execute a root shell on your system. So a buffer overflow is essentially a two-step process. One, I'm pushing malicious code onto the stack, but more importantly, because you're not doing explicit error checking on the variable size, instead of entering in 30 characters, I'm able to enter in 40, and I'm able to manipulate the memory address of the return pointer to point back to the malicious code I just put back on your stack. So as we'll learn about tomorrow, the way we prevent and deal with buffer overflow attacks is by going in and doing explicit error checking of all variables before they push on the stack. The good news is newer operating systems have built-in protection for buffer overflows. Linux systems utilize a split stack model. So in Linux, you're going to have two memory stacks. You're going to have a user stack, and you're going to have a kernel stack. All return pointers get put here, and all user variables get put here. So now, if you're not doing error checking, which stack is an adversary going to be able to overflow? This stack, but guess what? They can't touch the return pointer, and now an overflow would work, but it's not going to be able to cause code execution on the system. Microsoft, in their latest versions, use something called random memory allocation. The problem with traditional systems like XP is the memory stack is always in a predictable area in the buffer, which means I can guess what the variable is going to be able to point my return pointer back to that value. What Microsoft now does in Windows 7 is they do random memory allocation where they're going to randomly assign memory throughout your 4, 8, or 16 gigs of memory. And now because it's randomly assigned, it's not predictable. And because it's not predictable, you won't be able to guess what that value is. And now you can push info on the stack, but you can't actually guess the value. So a return pointer will never be able to be overwritten by the adversary. That's the good news. What's the bad news? Most control systems today are XP, or most control systems are 4 to 5 years back of Linux. So in 4 to 5 years, when we can replace out the hardware, the good news is the OS vendors solve this for us. But in ICS land, because of the older nature of the OSs that are in play, we typically have to rely on alternative filtering controls where we filter out size and character type to be able to prevent overflows from the size and SQL injection from the character type. That's why I keep pushing very heavily that you want to make sure that every time you go in and create a variable, determine the size and the character set and do explicit error checking on both. By doing explicit error checking on the size, we'll stop buffer overflows. And by doing explicit error checking on the character set, we'll stop SQL injection attacks from occurring within our environment. Then you have your historian. These are essentially databases that are going to be storing records, logs, and details of what's occurring within your environment. Because it's a database, it's a prime target for SQL injection attacks for occurring. Because you're typically going to use a web-based interface to be able to manage and search against that historian, authentication attacks, session ID, cookie hijacking, and of course buffer overflow attacks are all viable attack measures against it. So a lot of the attacks that we're seeing when we talk about historians, engineering workstations, HMI, because they're fundamentally OSs and databases just customized for a unique need in the control system world, a lot of our standard attack vectors that we've been talking about today are going to work very, very effectively in those areas. So anytime we're dealing with servers, anytime we're dealing with older servers, and anytime we're dealing with an environment where change is very difficult and modifications takes a really, really long time to occur, we're going to have issues with out-of-date services, extraneous services, missing patches, vulnerability exploitation, lack of error checking in the environment, and therefore a lot of the methods of bypassing authentication, session ID, fuzzing, overflows, injection attacks are all viable methods to go after these systems. Then we're going to go in now and look at attacking our network communications. So a lot of what we just covered set the stage for tomorrow. I showed you all the exposures and vulnerabilities. Tomorrow we're going to talk about mitigating measures for servers. Now we're going to jump in to attacks against network communication devices, and that's what Saturday is going to be about, defending and protecting and creating a secure network infrastructure within our environment. By nature of what control systems are essentially three things. Sensors that are typically in the field that are sending information back to a control decision support system, and that decision support system is then going to make changes to field devices like opening valves, closing valves, starting or slowing down motors. Because the sensors and motors are typically in remote locations, either close or far, but not directly with the decision support, there has to be communication. There has to be network communication in order for that to occur. And that network communication can often be target of an attack from sniffing, alteration, or denial of service attacks within our environment. So just as a quick review, remember that when we're dealing with network communication, we always utilize the seven layers of the OSI protocol stack in order to be able to go in and talk about the communication. So if we go in real quick, we have our seven layers. So physical is layer one, data link is two, network is three, transport is four, session is five, presentation is six, and application is seven. So we always use the OSI model whenever we're discussing network functionality, and then we always utilize TCP/IP whenever we're implementing it on a real network. So typically, if we're talking about switches, we're going to be at layer two. This is also where MAC addresses reside. If we're talking about routers, we're typically going to be at layer three. When we're talking about TCP/UDP, we're going to be at layer four in the protocol stack. So those are sort of the general layers that we'll be talking more about on Saturday when we get to securing our network communication. But that's the basic method of communication. Real quick review is layer one is the physical transmission of the binary data between the computers. So this is the actual transmission of the zeros and ones between two different systems in the communication. Traditionally, in control systems, you really have five different ways of this occurring. You have electrical, which is what's used with your common Ethernet. That's actually becoming less and less popular because of the wired connectivity of it. The second method is photo optic or fiber optic, where you're actually doing light transmission for the information. Once again, in IT land, those two are very popular. In control systems, they're becoming less and less popular because they require wires, cabling, and especially fiber optic. What's the problem with fiber optic cabling? It's not very robust. If you go in and you take a fiber optic cable and you pull it, or you start twisting it, or you run over it, you'll hear a crunching noise, and you will probably break the ability for that cabling to work. It's very, very fragile style cabling because it requires a crushed glass or similar substance with the refraction of the laser. So if you're going in and you're pulling, banging, or moving it, it's not going to function really well. What's one of the requirements when we're talking about RTUs and remote devices? Ruggedness. This stuff's going to be out there and beat on. It's going to be run over and hit and storms and weather. So if you have technology like fiber optic that's relatively fragile, that's not going to work or scale very well in that environment. So Ethernet and fiber optic, very, very common in IT, becoming less and less common in control systems. What are the three method and control systems that are very, very common? Radio frequency, which is going to be your traditional 802.11. You also have your microwave. We're starting to see more and more of, and we're also seeing satellite communication. Now, just to throw in a fourth one, a little infrared. The problem with infrared is it's line of sight, not far distances, so we're seeing a little less of that occurring. But the three methods that we see a lot of are the radio frequency, your microwave, and your satellite communication. Notice, big push at layer one on the wireless nature of communication because it's easier and more scalable. So layer one is, how do you receive the zeros and ones? Layer two is, what is the meaning of the zeros and ones? This is where your logical topology sit, like your Ethernet, your token ring, your FIDI or other communication. The networking layer three is responsible for routing your information. This is where Internet Protocol and the Internet Control Message Protocol, IP/ICMP, sit for routing. Layer 4 is transmitting your application data. Layer 5 is setting up a virtual session. Layer 6 is representing your data in a unified machine independent format. And layer 7 is the actual application that you're going to be communicating back and forth with in your environment and your system. So when we look at the actual implementation, you're typically going to go in and your applications are going to be HTTP, HTTPS, SSH. You're going to have some of your ICS specific protocols like Modbus. You're going to have your layer 4 TCP UDP. You're going to have your layer 3 IP ICMP. You're going to have your layer 2 Ethernet. And then as we talked about layer 1, you're going to be having your radio frequency, your microwave, your satellite, or your infrared to do the actual communication of the zeros and the ones. When we look at some of the common protocols and ports, this is going to become real important on Saturday when we start configuring and setting up our firewalls and our inline preventive measures to determine what traffic can or cannot flow within the environment. So you have a lot of TCP ports, you have UDP ports popping up. You'll notice that more and more you're going to be seeing UDP ports pop up as an alternative option. Why? Well, let's take a look. TCP is guaranteed delivery. UDP is not guaranteed delivery. Now, most people would say if availability is a high concern factor, then you would want guaranteed delivery. That's why a lot traditionally use TCP. What's the problem? If I'm doing guaranteed delivery, I have to set up a three-way handshake, which means I have to exchange information between the two parties. SYN, SYNAC, ACK. You have to have two-way communication for TCP natively to work on it. If I'm doing not guaranteed delivery with UDP, it's connectionless communication, and I can just send the traffic without any receipt of information, which means which protocol is more scalable if we're starting to set up data diodes and one-way communication. UDP. Natively, you can run UDP through data diodes, a one-way connection, because there doesn't need to be any exchange. You cannot run TCP natively. If I don't say natively, Tim heads explodes in the back. It's always fun to see on that. But natively, you cannot run TCP through a data diode because it requires a three-way handshake to occur. Now, the reason I always joke with Tim is because we always banter back and forth. He's like, well, yeah, Eric, you can run TCP through a data diode. There are solutions that will go in and allow you to do it. And I always sort of push back going, well, what are the solutions doing? They're converting to UDP to be able to send it over the wire. So yes, you can technically purchase appliances that will allow you to simulate TCP communication through a data diode, but in essence, they're converting it to a UDP connection to allow that to work. So you can sort of go in and proxy it, but you're really natively just converting to a UDP. So as we see data diodes being utilized more and more as a solution vector, that's why you're seeing more vendors allow UDP traffic, because it's more scalable to work in those diverse style environments. Now, if we're dealing with wireless, what is the fundamental problem in dealing with wireless? If we look at connectivity, what are the two general methods of connecting devices together to communicate at layer two? Hubs and switches. Hubs, every device plugged in sees the traffic for every other device. So hubs are very prone to sniffing. A switch, you only see the traffic going or coming from your system. You don't see any other traffic going over the network. So in physical wired environments, we want switches to limit the sniffing and ability for somebody to capture and grab information in our environment. What is a wireless access point?
Say a hub.
A hub. It's a hubbed environment, which means by nature of how wireless is set up, anybody within the vicinity of that access point can sniff and access anyone else's traffic that's going across that communication link. So because wireless is starting to be used more and more for flexibility reasons, and wireless utilizes a hub-based communication structure for sending the information back, all of a sudden, from a sniffing perspective, it makes it very, very easy to capture and gain access to information going across these environments. Now, encryption can help somebody intercepting your traffic, but remember, that is only going to work if you can control and manage the keys. And encryption is good for confidentiality. And in many cases, we're less concerned if somebody could read the information. We're more concerned whether they can spoof or alter the data. Now, the problem with traditional payload encryption is there is no authentication of the end host. If you look at your traditional SSL, your HTTPS, your secure socket layer, traditionally the client is authenticating the server with a digital cert, but the server doesn't necessarily authenticate the client with a cert, which means any client can connect to the server and encrypt their payload into the system, which means if I'm a clever attacker and I'm sniffing the transmission, what do I need to be able to spoof the end device? I only need the source IP address. What will never, ever be encrypted? The layer 3 header. The layer 3 header can never be encrypted because that's what's used for routing. Every single piece of information going over a network must have a readable, unencrypted IP header. So now you set up encryption, you're doing SSL back, you think it's great. I can get close to your RTUs. I can sniff the traffic, figure out your source IP, set up an SSL, and now spoof traffic in to cause inadvertent activity to potentially occur within your environment. So not only can attackers potentially read the traffic, which encryption will help, but I can spoof or hijack that connection and potentially send false information back into the environment. Now let's also be clear here on this encryption. These slides are throwing encryption around as a quick, easy way to protect, control, and manage the payload. Unfortunately, not a lot of devices fully support encryption. So yeah, that is a solution, but if you go out and start sniffing a lot of this traffic, most of it is plain text, readable information, because it was set up for availability or integrity, not confidentiality.